So what does he normally... Oh, come in, please. Yes, sit down. Sorry.
Time to retire to the drawing room.
More cheese? And here we are, a vision of tweed leather patches and cut glass tumblers. 19 away from 8. What makes a nation? We're going to wonder it this evening. Strong institutions, healthy democracy, cheese, free press, or shared values, common purpose. And what about words? What's their place in the scheme of things? The elegant expression of an idea. Is this ultimately how we truly know ourselves, how we cumulatively shape a mature nation? In the drawing room tonight, we're talking with a man who thinks there may be some truth in that. He's Robert Mann, Professor of Politics at La Trobe University, and along with quarterly essay editor Chris Fike, he's edited a new book. It's a wonderful collection, The Words That Made Australia, How a Nation Came to Know Itself. And on the side of shared values in our chat is Tim Soupomesane. He's a lecturer at Monash University's National Centre for Australian Studies. And his new book is a defence of multiculturalism called Don't Go Back Where You Came From. Welcome to you both.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Tim, you can stay. It's okay.
Thank you. I'm enjoying the snuff too much here in the drawing room, can I say. To leave.
More cheese, please. Now, Robert, this book's it's a bit of a go at revealing, through more than a century of writing, some of the insights that have formed us and our view of ourselves.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about the process and about that succession of ideas too.
Well, the truth is that I began by thinking of editing a book of essays, and the best essays in Australia had been done before. I thought I'd have another go at it. And then it just occurred to me that what was really interesting was not graceful essays, but those kind of interventions in something I think of as a conversation, which so... startled and interested people that they remained in national memory. And I think they remained in national memory because they said something, they put their finger on something which people had a vague sense of but hadn't yet properly articulated. And so it's like, it's a collection of, often the phrases stuck, like, you know, the forgotten people or the workers' paradise or the great Australian silence, and they were often connected to these really kind of... perceptive, insightful, illuminating interventions. And I thought if we put them all together, you actually have a really interesting account of my version of the national conversation over a century or more.
It's not just that collection of documents. It has a sort of a narrative sense or a...
Yeah. I mean, it's meant to have...
A coherence about it.
It's my interpretation and Chris's interpretation. We work together. Of what is, I think, one version of how people spoke to each other in this idea of a century-long conversation, trying to say, in this question that Australians have been interested in forever, who are we, what kind of society are we, what makes us distinctive, and so on. So it's an attempt to, as it were, illuminate something that's been going on for more than 100 years and which I think made Australia, because Australia was kind of nothing until people thought about what is it that we are, what is it that this nation means.
What are some of the steps along the way, and what are some of the sort of the landmark ideas in that in that little quest?
Well, I think the first really important intervention was from a Frenchman, Matin, who came to Australia and said...
That's almost inevitable, isn't it?
not always. But in this case it was. I call him our more modest Tocqueville. And he said, what makes this country interesting? And he really thought New Zealand and Australia were one, Australasia. And he said, they have really created a socialist society without theory. They're, you know, unlike the French or the Germans, who have meant much theory, they have no theory, but they've in fact created the workers' paradise on the basis of legislation and trade union and Labour Party kind of pressure. And so it seems to me that's the beginning of the conversation, to think that something... The workers are in control, and they've created something not through theory but through pragmatism. Then, say, the next, I think, I'm cutting some out, the next really important intervention is at the time of Anzac, and Ashmead Bartlett, the English journalist, riveted the nation with the idea that the Australians weren't kind of lower convict types, but the Australian man, and it was to do with men, had shown their worth at Gallipoli. And this was a report that went all over Australia and had an electrifying effect. And I think it was that there was a sense of inferiority in the Australian nation. Mm. They were a settler society and colony, but here the nation had shown its worth. So I think that's the next, and that really, strangely enough, remained the national mythology. Although because it was not a military triumph, it was it I think has been a very fine basis for the nation.
It's resilient, isn't it?
It's resilient and it lacks vainglory, which is what one of our authors, Inga Clendinnen, points out.
There's been recent attempts to sort of add a sense of that,
yes,
I think.
But it goes against the grain because, in fact, to have valour but not victory and to have a lot of suffering, because we also have Keith Murdoch.
Yes.
2 years later, at the end of that year, at the end of the Gallipoli experience, reporting to the Prime Minister Fisher, saying what a disastrous thing it has been for these brave men to have gone through this. And I think that cut out the vainglory from the tradition. And then, I'll just say one more move in the conversation.
Sure, yes.
D.H. Lawrence came out, I think, obviously one of the great novelists of the 20th century, a wonderful novelist, wrote Kangaroo.
A fabulous eye for the place.
An astonishing, a miraculous eye for Australia after such a short time. But he kind of, it's an ambivalent novel, but essentially he hated what he saw because he thought he saw it was a workers' democracy, but he thought you couldn't build a society without aristocracy and without class division. He thought no one ruled. It was a kind of workers' anarchy. He also thought it was imitative. When he walked through Sydney, he said he yearned for Piccadilly or for Covent Garden. And that was a real challenge to Australians, the thought of this incredibly intelligent Englishman of high sensibility thinking that this was an imitative place and without any kind of internal structure. And he hated democracy, essentially. Anyhow, the conversation then goes on, but people have not forgotten D.H. Lawrence. Still, his challenge to Australia was irritating people. When I was a student, people were worried about it. And again, Inga Clendinnen returns to it with anger when she gave Boyer lectures, only a few years ago.
Talking about us and this place in the drawing room with Robert Mann and Tim Soupomasane, Tim, our cultural selves, our sense of cultural identity is really important, whether that be in a D.H. Lawrence harking back to Trafalgar Square sense or in a more contemporary sense of multicultural identity.
Indeed.
Who are we, Tim?
Well, I think who we are is something that is determined in part by this national conversation that we have. Reading Robin and Chris's book made me think about the nation as a project. It's something that's ongoing and never really comes into full realization or completely into being. The historian Renan talked about the nation as being constituted by a daily plebiscite. And I think that's an important insight, again from another Frenchman, albeit not our Tocqueville. But it points to the fact that a national culture and national identity are things that aren't frozen in time. They're subjective to some extent and they require interpretation. And I think there's been a greater challenge to the Australian sense of nationhood in the past few decades than the waves of immigrants who've arrived in this country, the advent of a multi-ethnic, multicultural Australia. And I think we've passed the test with flying colours.
There's a level of discussion here which is about the relationship of that contemporary culture with Indigenous culture, but the other level of the continuous arrival. I mean, we define ourselves, multiculturalism is such an important concept because it pretty much is us.
Hmm. Well, I think historically it's really something that comes after white Australia and an assimilation style of incorporating immigrants. So in the post-war years, in those initial decades when you had European immigrants arriving in this country, there was an expectation that if you came to Australia as an immigrant, you had to discard your cultural identity and cultural traditions as baggage that belonged to the past, And what multiculturalism as an idea did was to repudiate that and to say that you can actually retain your cultural identity and your sense of who you are, and you can be Australian in more than one way, that there's no one typical or authoritative way to be Australian. And I think we don't often appreciate this point, that multiculturalism, far from being a repudiation or a rejection of Australian national identity, is in fact part of a nation-building project. It's about strengthening the Australian sense of self to include all those who arrive here, regardless of their backgrounds.
And that's as true, Robert Mann, is it not, of an Irish Australian and an English Australian as it is of a Vietnamese Australian and a Cameroonian Australian.
Yeah,
it's got historical roots, this idea.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, if you say that, I think one of the interesting things was that for a very long time, Australian identity was fought out over the question of the place of the Irish in what was a British Protestant nation.
We have a bit more of that this week, I think.
Yeah, that's right. There's a shadow again. But the illusion is that Australia had once a very kind of settled Anglo-Celtic conformity. And that wasn't true. There was actually a lot of tension between Protestants and Catholics, with the Catholics feeling a minority and moving to the Labour Party. But can I say about the multicultural question, just something when Tim was talking that interested me, I don't, in terms of the national conversation, we represent in our book multiculturalism by an intervention of someone you're a bit critical of, Ghassan Haj, but I think you will have liked that essay where he's a very radical sociologist, has a moment of epiphany.
A cultural epiphany.
He sees, you know, in his grandparents' old place in Bathurst, a pomegranate and an olive, a vine, and the ancient Mediterranean culture has rooted here. It's really interesting. But it's interesting that we felt we had to represent multiculturalism from a contemporary bit of writing rather than from when it really hit in the mid-70s. And I was going to ask, am I allowed to ask a question in the drawing room?
There are no rules.
It is a salon. Here, you must ask questions.
I was wondering whether we've missed a really great bit of writing. I think most of the writing we have is really great writing that came out in the mid-70s or at the time multiculturalism hit, because we couldn't find any.
Referring to We're a Weird Mob or...
We thought about They're a Weird Mob as an assimilation work, but that was incredibly popular and funny, but not great writing. And Al Grasby wrote stuff which, you know, was historic. Like if it was a book of documents, you'd have things of that sort, or even Whitlam speeches. But we didn't find any. I don't want to dwell on it. But the great bit of writing was very contemporary.
Well, I would have nominated Al Grasby's speech in 1973 when he first mentioned the word multicultural as a possible contender. And I think of some of the lines that he used in that speech. He referred to the family of the nation, and he made a reference to how in antiquity Romans would declare civis Romanus sum. I am a Roman citizen, knowing that everyone would understand what it meant, and he hoped that the declaration of I am Australian would have the same resonance. Looking back at the lineage of multiculturalism, I think it's a telling insight into what was going on in Al Grasby's and Gough Whitlam's heads when they embraced multiculturalism. This was never meant to reject an Australian national identity, but rather to reinforce and to strengthen it and make it more inclusive.
And you've got a really nice phrase in your book talking about multiculturalism. It's more than, you say, the ornamental qualities of diversity, which is, I mean, it's more than being able to buy a pad thai.
Well, look, I think we all appreciate the lifestyle dimensions of a multi-ethnic, multicultural Australia as an instinctive thing, but it's harder for us, so it seems, to appreciate the civic quality of this. And I think we sell ourselves short if we don't celebrate the true success of multiculturalism, which is that you've had millions of immigrants coming to this country, integrating into the national identity and culture, and have done so without the kind of social rancor or division that we've seen elsewhere.
I think the best book, or the best defence of multiculturalism, or Australian multiculturalism that I've read. And I think it's interesting that someone who's partly in the society, partly has a feeling for a world outside the society. I mean, with Tim coming from France, but from Laotian and Chinese background, has sort of seen things about Australia and its strengths, which I think has often been the case. That and that it's interesting that the I think the best defence of the kind of moral society we have and the freedom that is now exercised is David Malouf, again, who in a way is partly inside, partly outside the Australian society. I think often people bring things, what the older population takes for granted, new things are seen, and I think Tim has really seen things about the strength of multiculturalism, which I think is one of the things that clearly makes this a better society than it was when I was young, the ways in which migrant groups don't feel they have to assimilate to some kind of Anglo norm in order to be truly Australian. I think it's been one of the great successes. But it's not just peaceful integration, but it's actually the full citizenship of ethnic variety, which I think has been the great Australian success.
Yeah, and if you compare it to countries in Europe, for example, Germany, where they have traditionally withheld citizenship from those who didn't have German ancestry or lineage.
Yeah. And France, where they've withheld ethnicity from
precisely, and I think we've struck the sweet spot. We haven't imposed solidarity or nationhood on the one hand, and we haven't headed into the territory of a guest worker model either.
I'd like to say there's a negative thing in the story we've tried to tell in Words That Made Australia. And I think it still haunts us a bit, and that is the Indigenous question. I think there's been great success with integration of ethnic variety. I think, and there was a big attempt, and I think the great piece here is from Bill Stanner, the anthropologist, to break this great Australian silence about what is the moral meaning of the dispossession. But I'm of the view that that silence has never been fully broken, that the true meaning of what was done in the making of this country has never been fully acknowledged and recognised. And I actually think it affects other sorts of debates. I think one of the things about Australia, which is something that I don't admire, is a lack of radical thought on certain questions. And I think, as it were, smothering certain issues, preferring to keep them out of public discourse.
If we had the courage to attack that fundamental point, that cultural collision would give us a lot more.
And that's a point that Bernard Smith, who recently died, but a great art historian, great cultural historian, and calls his intervention is the spirit of Truganini, but his idea is that until we truly confront the history of this country and the dispossession, the country will somehow not be able to flourish fully.
That is the last great multicultural hurdle, Tim Sipomasan.
Well, I think it's a mindset issue, and Robert is right to raise the Indigenous question as a crucial question in our conversation today. I think perhaps what we're seeing is the legacy of the Geoffrey Blainey view of the national conversation history, this idea that there has to be a balance sheet in the national history and that you have to add up the achievements of the nation and have a positive sum at the end of the end of the day, and I think that corrupts our debate, and it turns the national conversation into an exercise of moral accounting, which is what it shouldn't be.
He's in the book because we've wanted to cover.
You've nothing if not fair-minded.
Nothing in this case. I'm normally not. In this book, I am very fair-minded.
A fascinating process, and thanks to both of you for participating in what John Howard would probably term the perpetual Australian symposium on national identity. But it's a good thing that we have it, and that it is in fact perpetual. Robert Mann and Tim Sipomasan, two new books. From Robert Mann, we have The Words That Made Australia, How a Nation Came to Know Itself, and from Tim Sipomasan, Don't Go Back to Where You Came From. That's been The Drawing Room this evening.